The third case for oral argument this morning is Mullett and McGuire Appellants versus Park Jefferson Speedway Appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and also Ms. Susan Sabers, an attorney from Sioux Falls. I understand, Mr. Parsons, you're presenting the first 20 minutes, and then Ms. Sabers, you'll do the rebuttal. Okay, and the Appalachian Speedway, we have Mr. Joel Voss and Mr. James Redmond. I understand, Mr. Voss, you'll be presenting the argument. Very well. Justice Sabers has disqualified himself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Glenn Severson, and I get to say this for the last time, Circuit Judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, who in 3 weeks will become Justice Severson, newest member of our court. So he will be sitting in place of Justice Sabers for this case. With that, Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court and counsel. This case involves the sometimes vexing concept of legal duty under the law of negligence. The trial court here held that Park Jefferson Speedway, a liquor licensee, owed no duty to the public to supervise its underage employees around its extensive beer and alcohol supply, to monitor and safeguard its alcohol, or even to use ordinary care in selecting and hiring who will be given access to its company alcohol without supervision. Catherine McGuire, my client, was severely injured as a result of the Speedway's failure to use ordinary care in these circumstances, and she respectfully suggests that the trial court's holding that there was no legal duty was incorrect and should be reversed for a jury trial on her claims of negligent supervision and negligent hiring. On a summary judgment motion, of course, the facts must be viewed in the light most favorable here to Ms. McGuire, and she's entitled to the benefit of all reasonable inferences from the evidence. And the relevant facts are these, very quickly. Dean Curry was an underage drug and alcohol user. He walked out of court-ordered substance abuse treatment and was wanted by the court for violating those orders. His mother, his sister, and his uncle all happened to work for Park Jefferson Speedway. And so he asked them for work. And he believed he was applying for the job of a kitchen worker. But actually, he found out that he had been hired to be what they called their beer runner. And essentially, what that position entailed was he was de facto in charge of the beer and alcohol supply, the kegs, liquor, vodka drinks and things like that, other types of drinks. He had a supervisor, but she worked in the kitchen virtually all of the time. And he would communicate with the stands, the concession stands, and the bars located on the property. If they needed something, he would take it out to them and drop it off, including food items and things like that, but primarily alcohol. And so he was given this job without even being asked a question about whether he had a problem with alcohol, whether he ever had, no background check, and in fact, they never even asked his mother, do you think maybe your son, is that a good fit for him to put him in charge of our alcohol? She worked for them. They didn't even ask that question. Virtually every shift that he worked, he was, once he figured out, hey, I'm in charge, I have all this alcohol around me, and no one's watching, he decided to just essentially get drunk while he worked every shift. And so for an entire summer, every time he worked, he would start drinking. When he arrived at work, he'd start with a couple of beers. He'd put them in a pop cup and continued on just drinking as much as he could possibly drink throughout his eight-hour shift. He drank whiskey. He drank vodka drinks. He drank rum. And no one ever suspected anything. Park Jefferson never knew because no one watched him. On the night in question, he started his shift as usual, drank some beers, worked, you know, was delivering the hot dog buns and the beer and alcohol out to the concession stands, drank a lot that particular night. The record shows several beers, Jack and Cokes, four vodka drinks, rum, and then at the end of the night, when he was pretty drunk, as he testified, he finished the night with, poured himself a 32-ounce beer and went out in the parking lot and drank that before he drove off the property. He made it about 10 feet off the property. He was so drunk, he was driving on the wrong side of the road. He was speeding, admittedly, and he, 10 feet literally from Park Jefferson Speedway, he plowed into a passing motorcycle and severely injured my client. No one noticed that he'd been drinking that day because he didn't even, both he and his alleged supervisor testified they didn't remember even seeing each other that shift. So he didn't really even bump into anyone that day other than Catherine McGuire. The question here is not whether Park Jefferson's actions constitute negligence. And it's not whether, if these actions were negligent, they approximately caused damages to my client. Those are jury questions. The question here is the legal issue of whether Park Jefferson Speedway, as a liquor licensee, as any liquor licensee, has a duty at all to supervise its underage employees around its beer and alcohol supply.
As a licensee, and he was consuming on their premises, do the dram shop statutes have any applicability here?
I think that there are a couple different statutes that address this. There's one statute, I think the first one, and they're right next to each other, Section 78 of that dram shop law, says there's no civil liability for serving alcohol. And that has been held, that legislatures has abrogated a decision by this court saying you can't have liability for violating it if you are legally serving alcohol. There's another statute that we've relied upon, too, for the concept of duty outside of the law of negligence, which is 32, it's Section 79. And that statute says that no on-sale licensee may permit any person less than 21 years old to loiter on the licensed premises or sell, serve, dispense, or consume alcoholic beverages on such premises. That has not been abrogated by the South Dakota legislature, and we contend that this imposes a duty not regarding the legal sale of alcohol to customers, but regarding the supervision of alcohol on its premises.
And how did the trial court deal with that?
The trial court held that it did not impose a duty because it concluded that the statute was only enacted for the protection of minors. And many courts have held that it's not only enacted for the protection of minors, but also for the general public. I mean, they're not mutually exclusive. Statute can be enacted for several valid reasons, and we contend that this statute was enacted to protect minors, but also to protect the general public from minors who are given unsupervised access to alcohol by a liquor licensee. So
but
we can.
Aside from that, the statute uses the word permit.
Yes.
Which means permission, or and even under your definition, I know you've cited conflicting in the briefs, conflicting definitions of the word permit. But even under your definition, which is to make possible or to give an opportunity, it seems to me that that encompasses some level of knowledge and a conscious decision to give permission. That's really not what happened in this case.
No, I think permit is broader than just one definition. A dictionary lists some alternate definitions, and I don't think those are mutually exclusive either. It implies, I think, some measure of knowledge or reckless indifference. I mean, if you just leave alcohol in a room, and
I didn't see anything in the dictionary about reckless indifference.
Well, it says to make possible or allow. And so if you allow, by your willful blindness, alcohol to or underage people, employees, to have free access to alcohol, and, you know, I'm just not going to be at work that day, so I don't know that they're taking it. I think that fits. I don't think the legislature intended a cramped definition of permit. But really, you know, the statutory issue, I think, is important because you can impose a duty either by under the common law or statute. For us, the statute is important because it's evidence of negligence per se, and we wouldn't be entitled to a directed verdict if we showed that they violated it. But we would be entitled to the jury instruction that says violation of the statute is evidence of negligence. So we want that instruction. But the primary argument here is that under the common law, under the law of negligence, irregardless of any statute, there is a duty by a liquor licensee to supervise its underage employees around alcohol.
Are you saying the common law as in precedent or a common law as recognized in the restatements?
Both. I think as recognized, this court utilizes and consults the restatements, but this court's law as it's developed over the last century is not limited by the restatements. And, you know, I want to give the trial court credit here. To be fair to it, at the time it made this decision, it did not have the benefit of this court's recent decision in Curlin versus Halverson, which is really the seminal case now in negligent supervision and negligent hiring, and it's an extremely helpful decision. That case involved whether there was a duty by a contractor to supervise its off-premises work site employee. There was a contractor on a job site, and he committed an intentional assault on the off-premises job site against a competing employee for another contractor. This court held there was a legal duty in that case. Whether there was negligence or proximate cause was for the jury. But Curlin really very carefully sorts out the types of claims you can bring against an employer for the conduct of its employee. And the first one it talks about is respondeat superior. And that's not in this case. We did not appeal from the trial court's grant of summary judgment on that issue. The second is the restatement of torts 317, and that involves the duty to control or the duty to prevent the misconduct of a third person, and that includes employees. And that section specifically applies to, it says, a master is under a duty to exercise reasonable care so as to control his servant while acting outside the scope of his employment. So that particular restatement is limited to when employees are acting outside the scope of their employment. I think we fit under that. Curry was acting outside the scope of his employment when the injuries occurred. But the best fit for this case is the ordinary tort of negligent supervision.
I just want to go back to your 317 before you finish that, because I think there is a distinction in this case and in Curlin, which you use, in that in this case the accident happened off-premises and not on the part of the premises that that the Speedway controlled. And of course, 317 requires that it be on premises.
That's right. That the servant is upon the premises.
So how do you reconcile that?
Well, I think it fits here because the true negligence in this case is the failure of Park Jefferson to supervise him while he's. You know, the misconduct of Curry was getting drunk on the premises while he was at work. So that's the misconduct that that they should have controlled. So the misconduct occurred on the premises because his misconduct was getting drunk at work, stealing the alcohol. But
the cases that have interpreted have looked at where the status of the accident was.
Some of them have. And that's why I think this isn't the best fit, because the Curlin decision is very careful. It then says, you know, there's another type of claim. And on page 451 of that decision, it says there is a subtle difference between a restatement towards 317 claim and a claim of violation of the duty of ordinary care. And that encompasses just a claim for negligent supervision. Now, there's been a suggestion in the brief that a negligent supervision claim and a claim brought under 317 are one and the same, and they're tied to each other. But that's just impossible because, as we've said, Restatement 317 only applies when a servant is acting outside the scope of his employment. A negligent supervision claim inherently involves within the scope of employment. And the other distinction Curlin makes is a negligent supervision claim is made against the employer for violating its duty to conduct itself reasonably. So that's the distinction here.
I mean, but then you have to establish foreseeability then, don't you? If you are going to go on a pure negligent supervision claim, so how is it foreseeable?
I think it's entirely foreseeable that if you do not take any measures or use ordinary care as a liquor licensee to supervise your underage employees, especially ones who have alcohol problems.
Because they didn't know he had an alcohol problem.
They didn't know, but we're contending it was negligent that they didn't, because they never asked. And they didn't even ask his mom, who worked for him. And they should have known. And but even regardless of whether an employee has an alcohol problem, I think it's foreseeable that if you don't supervise alcohol as a liquor licensee, your underage employees around it put some measures, some security, something, ordinary care, it's foreseeable that those kids will get drunk and injure someone right when they're leaving the property.
Are we presuming then that because a person's underage that there's a potential that they would abuse alcohol? Are we really saying that about, is that maybe casting aspersions on young people?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the legislature's made that policy determination by putting an age limit on the consumption of alcohol.
But that doesn't mean that because they can't drink it that they're going to abuse it if they get a chance to, does it?
It doesn't mean that every kid will, but it certainly means that I think you have a duty to make sure that you're not making it freely available to anyone.
If the legislature has legislated as far as the age of consumption for minors, have they also legislated in the area of when and how minors can come into contact with alcoholic beverages that are for sale?
Yes, absolutely. And that's the statute I read earlier, 35479. No on-sale licensee may permit any person less than 21 years old to even loiter on the property to sell, serve, dispense, consume alcohol. They can't touch it if they're under 21. And here, that's the law. And here, Dean Curry was in basically de facto in charge of the alcohol, and he's underage. And so that's a violation of a legal duty, a statutory duty. Even if there no statute existed, we have the law of negligence. And to answer your question, courts all over have found, you know, there's not a lot of cases on this area, but there are significant, the courts that have addressed these types of specific facts have found, you know, there are four factors that really create a duty, and they're all present here. And these are factors that I've kind of gleaned from the cases, not that are listed anywhere. But the key elements, I think, in creating a duty is, one, is it a liquor licensee? Is it someone whose their main business is selling alcohol and beer? And we have that here. Are we talking about underage employees? These are people that generally are not allowed to come in contact under by law with alcohol. And we have that here. Are the underage employees drinking company alcohol? I mean, is it not someone shows up for work drunk? Are they being allowed by the failure to use ordinary care to have access to alcohol they otherwise wouldn't have access to? And that's what we have here. And then fourth, are they using it while they're on the job? They're using it in the scope of their employment. I've never seen a case where you had all four of those factors and a court said, well, there's no duty.
Are we expanding the definition of duty in South Dakota by accepting your argument?
I don't think at all. I think this fits comfortably within the definition of a legal duty because of those factors I cited. I mean, Curlin, you're talking about, held there was a legal duty. You're talking about an employee who's not even, he's off premises on a job site where the supervisor's not even there. And that was an intentional assault. And held there was wasn't necessarily negligence, that's for the jury to decide, but held there's at least a legal duty of the employer to monitor, to supervise that employee. Here, there has to be a legal duty to supervise, by liquor licensee, to supervise alcohol. And it's, you know, it's not only reasonable to have expected Park Jefferson Speedway to use ordinary care to take some minimal measures. You know, I'm not trying to be theatrical. I think it's outrageous they did not do so. It's outrageous. Courts have, you know, I've mentioned courts have found this. The Massachusetts Supreme Court is a good example. The Tobin case. A business that makes money by serving liquor where teenagers are known to be present is not engaging in ultra-hazardous activity, but the situation is so fraught with foreseeable risk that a business that is in a position to control or reduce the risk has a duty to do so.
Counsel.
Thank you. I thought the Arizona Supreme Court's en banc decision was very closely on point. The combination of alcohol, gasoline, and immature judgment is as deadly as statistics suggest, and a liquor licensee storing alcohol has a duty to exercise reasonable care to guard that substance from those who will foreseeably endanger the public by its use. And that case involved not even employees. Kids got in and were stealing it. This is their employee who didn't have to, he barely had to use surreptitious means to drink this alcohol and take it.
Did the trial court consider this argument, and what did the trial court say about your negligent supervision argument?
It was kind of confusing because we had two summary judgment hearings. At the first summary judgment hearing, the court granted summary judgment to the defendants on the negligence per se claim, but denied summary judgment on the negligent supervision claim. And then more time passed, some more discovery occurred, and then they renewed their motion for summary judgment. And the second time, the court said, no, there's no legal duty. And I think it got tripped up on Restatement Section 317, thinking that limited negligent supervision claims.
Wasn't the court focused more on proximate cause at the first hearing? That's sort of the way I read the
focused decisions. Yes, focused more on it, but he specifically said in his ruling, I find there is a legal duty. He later backtracked on that point. But yeah, you're correct. He focused more on proximate cause.
Did the court have, the court didn't have Curlin versus Halverson either
no,
at that time?
No, the court did not have Curlin versus Halverson. And frankly, this is not an area of the law that this court has had an opportunity to delineate very much prior to Curlin. Now I think it's a very helpful decision and we know what's happening. I did also just want to mention the negligent hiring claim. If there was ever a case of negligent hiring, this is it. I mean, all they had to do was ask Mrs. Curry, should we put Dean in charge of the alcohol? She would say, no, he's frankly an alcoholic and he's in substance abuse treatment. I don't think that's a wise decision. That's all we're at. Ask a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Voss, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to begin by making a few comments about the facts of this case, because there are a few additional facts that do bear some emphasis. In this case, the employee at issue, Dean Curry, was a short-term employee. He had been employed for about 10 weeks, and this was a track that just had races on weekends at the time the accident occurred. And the evidence is, the record is clear that for about the first 3 weeks when he was learning the job and people were watching him more closely, he was not drinking. It was later on that he began to consume alcohol on premises.
You say he was hired for 10 weeks, but that's the racing season, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think
he was a seasonal employee hired for the season.
Yes, he was a seasonal employee. He was hired around the beginning of the season and probably would have completed out the season but for the accident. I don't think it was quite done in August when the accident occurred. He did not return after that. But the point was Mr. Curry knew how to control his behavior. He knew that he wasn't supposed to be drinking on the job, and he knew enough not to. Later on, he figured out that he could steal, and he understood that he was stealing. He was asked, in his deposition, he stated, as long as no one caught him, it was free beer. He understood, though, that he was stealing. He was asked whether he knew whether he should be drinking or not. He said, of course I'm not supposed to be drinking. He knew the policy and disregarded that policy. And so we're dealing with someone who is underage in that he was 20, but not a minor. He was legally responsible for his actions and understood what he was doing, and understood that what he was doing was not in the employee's, in the employer's interest, and did it nonetheless. About the events of that particular night, the one part of the record that doesn't get any mention or emphasis by the appellants is that he was observed by other employees on that night, not his direct supervisor, but other employees witnessed him. His mother, who's been mentioned a couple of times by the appellant, testified in her deposition that she was surprised by the accident because she had seen him on three or four prior occasions that night, close enough to observe him, and didn't note that he appeared intoxicated or smelled of alcohol.
What was his blood test result?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor.
Was not in evidence?
It probably is, and I don't know it. What happened was, and I'm certain it was substantial.
Whether somebody thought or noticed he was drunk, the blood test result would show that he definitely was.
Yes, so we're not disputing that he was intoxicated.
Okay.
But the question was, when you're looking at is there a duty and what the scope of that duty is, it's clear that Park Jefferson Speedway didn't have actual knowledge that he was stealing and getting intoxicated on the job, and the assertion or implication is that they should have known but had turned around and closed their eyes and weren't looking. Well, on the night of that accident, you have his mother observing him three or four times and saying he didn't appear intoxicated, he didn't smell of alcohol. Well, what happened was somewhere around 11:30 after the races are done, is when he begins consuming the 32 ounces of alcohol that was mentioned that he had put in a Coke cup so that people wouldn't see that it was alcohol, and finishes consuming that in his vehicle between midnight and then.
But that's a jury question. I know you wanted to give us these facts, but I mean, how much he drank, whether people noticed he was drinking, all that's a jury question. The question I think we have to decide is whether there's a legal duty that exists between an employer and the public to supervise.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I will concede that. But the reason why you bring it up or it's mentioned is that it's a question of how broadly or how narrowly are you going to define the duty? Is the duty to monitor someone who you know to be an unreformed alcoholic, as they put it? Or is it a duty to monitor, a minor who has as part of his job description transporting liquor from one station to another? If you're making it as specific as the appellants would like to make it, saying you've got an unreformed alcoholic here, then these questions I think go to the scope of the duty as to whether the company had any reason to know whether he was intoxicated on the job. And so I understand your point. I don't want to get bogged down in the facts, but I think those do bear mentioning because they go to the extent to which Park Jefferson Speedway should have known if that triggers the duty. What should they have known? So that was the reason for bringing that up. The appellants have noted, when you're looking at whether a duty exists under South Dakota law, you have two sources. You either have a statutory source for that duty or you have a common law source for that duty. And they place considerable attention on South Dakota codified laws 35-4-78 and 35-4-79. And respectfully, we disagree with the analysis that they have made. The statute that they hang their hat on is 35-4-79, which says that no licensee will permit an underage person to serve, sell, or consume liquor on the premises. That statute goes on to say that a violation of the statute is a Class 2 misdemeanor. From that construction, it's similar to the preceding statute, 35-4-78, which says you won't sell to a minor and then says that a violation is a Class 1 misdemeanor. That's how the statute existed in 1982 when the court made the decision in the Walls case that was later overturned legislatively by adding the second paragraph in 35-4-78, which says, however, you don't get civil liability imposed on you by serving, because it's consumption that is the cause of injury.
Their assertion is that because 35-4-79 was not amended in the same way, somehow that section creates a civil duty and civil liability. That is not the best and most warranted reading of the statute. The best reading of the statute is that it creates a criminal offense, class 2 misdemeanor, which is less serious than the class 1 misdemeanor imposed by 35-4-78. And the Supreme Court in the Wegleitner case noted that there is this distinction between civil and criminal liability, that 35-4-78 is a criminal statute, was amended by this legislature to make clear that it did not have a civil liability component. Likewise, 35-4-79 is a criminal statute and doesn't say anything about imposing civil liability. And so to read a duty from there is to add language not present in the statute, and is taking the same approach that was taken in the Walls case that then was legislatively overturned. And so we think that there's no basis or no sound basis for arguing with the circuit court's determination that 35-4-79 did not create a civil civil liability. And as we had noted, the circuit court indicated that 35-4-79 was intended for the protection of the actual minor and doesn't have any component that's readily apparent extending that to society at large or injured third persons. After discussing the criminal the statute and the statutory basis, then the analysis next turned to Section 317, which is should be understood in the context of Restatement Section 315, that generally there's no duty to prevent harm to third persons, and then 317 is one in a set of four statutes or four restatements where they state the exceptions. And those exceptions apply, as this court has noted, when there's both a special relationship and then a foreseeable injury. And so 317 limits those limits where there's a special relationship by saying if the injury occurs in the premises that are in possession of the master or using a chattel of the master, then you have a special relationship. Otherwise, you don't have a special relationship.
Is that Mr. Parsons mentioned that he thought that the trial court may have focused on 317 and Curlin versus Halverson in order to say that there's no duty here. Is that your understanding of what happened, or did the trial court also consider, apart from 317, just common law and negligent supervision?
I think the trial court did focus its analysis on 317. I don't think that's a fatal flaw. When you look at Curlin versus Halverson, if I can quarrel with one part of it, it does do a 317 analysis, and then it goes on to talk about the negligent hiring and negligent supervision. But negligent supervision, the way it's conceptualized here, ends up being the same question as is addressed by Restatement 317. That is, what was your duty? The duty that they're saying is the duty to supervise him so that he didn't go and hurt third persons.
Isn't the 317 more like a duty to control your employee when the employee is able to be controlled, either because the employee is in a chattel owned by the employer or on the employer's premises, whereas this negligent supervision may be a broader scoped type of responsibility?
I certainly think negligent supervision has the potential to be broader. Negligent, you're still concerned with things that are outside the scope of their employment, though, because if it was inside the scope of the employee's employment, then you've got respondeat superior, and you don't need negligent supervision.
It doesn't matter in this case that he was so close to the premises and was actually going and coming and he was leaving. Right there as he left the premises. So.
That certainly makes it a more sympathetic argument than if it was 2 miles down the road. But it's not on premises, and it's also distant in time. It's over an hour after he had clocked out. And so it's clear that he's no longer under the control of the employer when this happens.
Is that a duty question or a fact question?
I think whether he was under the control of the employer is a duty question. And I don't think that there's a question of fact as to whether he was still under the control of his employer at 1 in the morning.
Mr. Parsons addressed the duty to control as supervising during the time when he had access to the alcohol and was drinking. Isn't that the issue on duty?
They cited one case that interpreted it that way. When you look at the case law that was cited and relied upon by the circuit court, the vast majority of cases that were considering that issue under 317 are not focusing on on what was happening on premises, but are focusing on the...
What about common law duty, not 317?
As far as common law duty to supervise...
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. When you're looking at the common law duty, they're focusing just entirely on foreseeability and getting away from any concept of is there a special relationship. And that, I think, is you're still looking at, as far as supervision, who's the foreseeable class of persons and who could be injured by this, and what's your relationship to them. And so I think you still are focusing on what are his activities, who could be injured while he's on the job. And that class of persons is not the class of person who is injured here. But I think there is that difficult issue as far as the common, once you're past 317 and looking at negligent supervision, what's the scope of that duty? How broadly or how narrowly do you get to define it? And I think that their definition comes in way too particular as far as...
Well, we look at foreseeability. Isn't that... that's been pretty much what this court has used as a touchstone for finding a duty. Is it foreseeable that if an underage person has unlimited access to alcoholic beverages, that person might abuse it and cause injury to someone?
Sure. And I think in Curlin, the way that it was stated was... is it when you're dealing with an allegation that you're supposed to be preventing the misconduct directed towards a third person, it's both foreseeability and the existence of a special relationship. Thank you.
We had a malfunction with the lights. You actually have 2 minutes left. I didn't want to interrupt you again. Do you have anything else?
I don't. I
okay, very good.
I have one more question, though.
Certainly.
Now, I guess I'm not exactly familiar, but my understanding is that actually there was no other way to get to this facility except for driving. I mean, they knew that he was using his own vehicle to get there. They didn't provide any transportation to and from, did they?
No, the Park Jefferson Speedway did not provide any transportation. I think that's not as clear-cut of a factor as you might think, though, Your Honor, because... as was noted several times, his mother and uncle worked there as well, and so certainly there were alternate means of transportation for him to go home in the event he was unable to safely drive himself.
Let me follow up on a question too, so as long as you have this time. you mentioned now a special relationship, and now where does that fit in with the common law duty to supervise?
That and that is one part where Curlin is really unclear, and because in the Curlin analysis went through all the 317 factors and found the special relationship there in the context of 317, and then when moved on to looking at negligent hiring and negligent supervision, the special relationship's not mentioned in the analysis in Curlin, and so it's an open question.
You're saying
I believe it to be an open question. I think the better analysis is that you still have to find that special relationship. That, it's because I still think you're in the general rubric of trying to prevent misconduct directed to third persons, and so I think the restatement analysis is the better one. But I think Curlin it leaves that somewhat unresolved.
As long as you have time, I have one question too. In your brief, you didn't respond to the Barger versus Cox case, which was cited by the other side. And in that case, this court found a similar duty to supervise underage people after hours that were drinking at an employer's premises.
Yes, and if I may respond to Barger, I do see that my time is up, so I will try to be brief. Barger dealt with a distinguishable fact pattern that you had people, you had minors living at this resort, working and then residing on the premises, 24 hours a day in general. And so it was much more of a in loco parentis probably type of concept, and the supervision that was undertaken there was much more significant than simply posting a policy, and so Barger is distinguishable on that basis. And Barger is also a very interesting case in that the court found a duty and then also found that it could find no violation of that duty on a motion for summary judgment. Because it had no, they said the employer had no duty to monitor these minors who were 16 and 17 years old 24 hours a day, and so while Barger finds a duty, it still found that it could resolve that on a motion for summary judgment standard. So that's maybe a little bit unusual result under the current jurisprudence, but it tends to suggest that duty was not as broad as the appellants have suggested.
Thank you. Ms. Sabers, you have 10 minutes.
If I may, I wanted to start where Justice Zinter left off with Barger. I would like to remind the court that in Barger, we are talking about misconduct of an employee that happens entirely off duty. The drinking of those children in the cabins at the Latch String in Barger starts after they're off work. They're in their own premises. They're in their own home or temporary home for the summertime. That's when they get drunk. Here, Dean Curry gets drunk while he's on premises, while he's on duty, not just on premises, but while he's on duty. In Barger, the accident actually happens 15 miles away from the Latch String. Not 300 feet, not 30 feet, like we've got here in this case, but 15 miles away from the Latch String when they're trying to take one of their friends who has injured an elbow into the local hospital. So we've got a completely more distant accident. If you're talking about the action.
But these were kids living there, and there was some at least suggestion, or there's obviously a local parental or substitute parental responsibility in that situation.
And it's interesting, when I reread Barger this morning, in the entire discussion from this court on assumption of duty in loco parentis, it does not come up once, Justice Zinter. The entire discussion, page 168 of your opinion, you talk about the one thing the employer did to assume this duty. What did they do? They posted a no alcohol for minors policy, and they told their minor employees, don't drink alcohol. That was it. page 168 of this court's opinion. That's the only fact that this court points to when they said the duty was assumed. In loco parentis, although a great theory, was missing at least from the assumption of the legal duty. And we are only here again to discuss legal duty. Mr. Voss got up and said, well, Barger is factually distinguishable. Well, if it's factually distinguishable, maybe he can make those good arguments, those proximate cause arguments to a jury. But here we're talking only about duty. And I wanted to say one other way that Barger helps. Judge Jensen here, in his opinion, found that there was a question as to whether all of these problems that Dean Curry got himself into while he was at work, whether that was the proximate cause. That was a jury question. In Barger, there was no such finding. There was no such finding. In Barger, the court was free to find, on summary judgment, that as a matter of law, there was no violation or breach of that duty. And I would say that this presents the exact opposite scenario, where the trial court opinion that is up on appeal here has already found that there is a question of fact on that proximate cause issue. So you are, in a sense, in the reverse position, as was the Barger court. I wanted to talk a little bit about it's difficult for me to sit there and listen to the concept that they had no actual knowledge that Dean Curry was getting drunk, that that is somehow a defense. That is, by virtue of its existence, the best part of the negligent supervision claim. How is the fact that you turned a blind eye to an underage, unreformed alcoholic who was drinking heavily? He didn't sneak a beer. He snuck two beers. He snuck four Smirnoff vodkas. He snuck two rum and cokes. He snuck a few more. And then he filled his pop glass, 32-ounce pop glass, with some more beer and went out to the parking lot to continue. This isn't an occasional sneaking of beer. Dean testified under oath, and it's in the record. Dean was very forthcoming about his proceedings. 8 out of the 10 races, he was buzzing. He called it happy. I was in a good buzzed-up state, and that language is quoted throughout our brief. It's not even so much as to the negligent hiring claim, it's important that he was an unreformed alcoholic. But as to the negligent supervision claim, what's important is what they repeatedly, race after race, turned a blind eye to. And it's not even so much that they turned a blind eye. They just closed them all together. They weren't looking at this kid. Mr. Voss comes up and says, well, his mother saw him a couple of times on the night of the accident, and she didn't sense anything. Again, it's a decent proximate cause argument. He's certainly left to argue that to the jury, but we're here today to talk about duty and not to talk about factually whether they did. Maybe somebody else should have seen him. Of course they should have. They've got an unreformed alcoholic delivering their beer, delivering their hard liquor, and delivering all of their booze, basically on premises. Justice Konenkamp, you asked about the duty to control versus the duty to conduct yourself reasonably, and I think that's why Curlin versus Halverson is so important. Because in Curlin, I think what the court does is points out that 317 is difficult to apply to a negligent supervision case. And certainly Mr. Voss and Mr. Redman have cited some cases where 317 has applied to those cases. But what Curlin says is it's not a perfect fit. It's not that good of a fit here. And Curlin says we really have three available causes of action. One, respondeat superior. It's been dismissed and that was not appealed. But 317, at least in my analysis, is almost a pseudo respondeat superior. We've now taken the employee outside the scope of his employment, but we're still talking about the employer and the duty to control that employee, and is there a strong enough connection there? And that's why 317 has the imposition of the requirements on premises or using a chattel of the employer. We're still talking about that as the negligence, your duty to control that employee. We can't call it respondeat superior because the employee is indisputably outside of the scope, but it's still kind of that type of negligence. What Curlin makes clear, and I don't think there's anything confusing about Curlin, what Curlin makes clear is we have this common law duty. If you're an employer, especially here, you know, you're an employer handling tons of alcohol. If you're an employer, you have a standalone duty to conduct yourself responsibly. And that's really the heart of this negligent supervision claim. And I think, Your Honor, you brought that up when you were talking about, here's a duty to control. Curlin says that's 317, excuse me. Here's a duty to conduct yourself as an employer responsibly and non-negligently. And that truly is the common law duty and where the negligence
where does spatial, now counsel brought up this idea of a special relationship having to exist in a negligent supervision claim. What's your response to that?
I think under 317, there's some argument that it needs to be there. Two arguments there. First, special relationship under the restatement is an employee-employer relationship. That fits the restatement's definition. So right there, you automatically have a special relationship. What I actually see is when we're talking about duty under the South Dakota case law, the court has said we either need a relationship between the defendant and the plaintiff, or at a minimum, we need foreseeability. And I think that's actually where Mr. Voss was arguing, although I think he called it a special relationship. Under the restatement, Your Honor, employee-employer relationship is inherently a special relationship, meeting that requirement.
What do you say about the, you know, South Dakota legislature has said in a slightly different context that we're not going to burden the people who supply alcohol with liability. We're going to put the responsibility for excessive abusive drinking on the person who does that drinking. Or what you is what you're asking now a change in policy against what the legislature has said?
I don't believe so, nor did Judge Jensen. And in that aspect of his ruling, this table did not appeal that ruling, Your Honor, and I don't know that it's necessarily before the court. But my response is this. This was not Park Jefferson. Thank you. This was not Park Jefferson going out and selling to this minor. Maybe that would be a different case. This was not Park Jefferson going out and selling to some of-age adult. With all of the rules on don't sell to minors, don't give to minors, don't let minors consume, it just begs reason to say that our legislature somehow meant to allow an opening for you to employ an underage unreformed alcoholic and then ignore him when he's consuming vast amounts of your alcohol. This is not that case. I think it is absolutely outside of those statutes, if for no other reason than Dean was stealing this alcohol. He was sneaking it. I don't think the legislature meant to immunize liquor sellers. No, in that regard, they don't have a duty to supervise their employees, but everyone else does. I don't think the dram shop statutes were meant to be so broad, nor did Judge Jensen. And again, that ruling was not appealed from in this appeal. Judge, soon to be Justice Severson, you were discussing negligent supervision and the fact that it occurred on the premises. The case that Mr. Voss referred to is Seguro versus Comiskey, and it's an interesting case where the Arizona Supreme Court does say inherently negligent supervision occurs on premises, on hours, while the employee is on duty. And I think it's a very good example to say 317 doesn't work so well for these negligent supervision claims, and again is why I come back to Chief Justice Gilbertson's writing in the Curlin case, separating those out. I think the chief used the word subtle. He said they're not the same thing. It's a subtle difference between those two. 317 isn't such a good fit exactly for that reason. Inherently, the negligent supervision occurs while the employee is working, while the employee is on the premises, and while the employee is actually doing, you know, at least partially the master's bidding, although here, that's hard to argue, I think. Mr. Voss ended to say,
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good day.